Hello, everybody. Time for another Shop Talk show. This episode is going to be a rapid-fire episode where Dave and I answer as many questions as we possibly can in this short hour that we have together. We're going to be talking about things like bootstraps hiding classes, and a first-time conference goer is wondering about the worthiness of going to conferences, gzip versus minification, WordPress loading scripts in the header instead of the footer, lots of stuff to talk about. There's a good one about web-based push notifications. Do you even know you could do that on the web? Because you kind of can. Performance stuff and DOM stuff and just so much stuff to talk about. Can't wait to get into it. I should mention that this episode is brought to you by CodePen Pro. In fact, if you want to learn all of the features of CodePen that you could have if only you were pro, go to codepen.io/pro, and there's a table there comparing the features and explaining all the different features you get, from private pens to drag and drop, asset uploading to live view, collab mode, professor mode, so many things that you get. And I should mention that, you know what? We've never changed the price of CodePen Pro since we've created it ever. And I tend to think that that's probably maybe not going to last forever. I can't promise you when and if it's ever going to change, but anybody that, you know, is currently paying for CodePen Pro will be grandfathered into that for as long as they have it. So it might be maybe a good time to think about going pro on CodePen, especially as we're maybe about in the next few months going to drop some pretty major new pro features. Dave, kick it off.
Hey there, shopping maniacs. You're listening to another episode of the Shop Talk Show podcast, all about front-end web design development, UX, web design development, UX, web design development, UX. I'm Dave Rubin.
All those Coyier. Things. What? Which Lodash function would we use to, like, remove the duplicates from that array of...
Underscore dot... Is it, like, redundant?
Unique?
Unique?
I bet there is one. I bet there is one to, like, take out the duplicates from an array. Anyway, this is our rapid-fire episode. Very tough. I like arrays. We're gonna do as many questions as we can. I think I put even more than 10 in there this week. No guests, no drama, just me and Dave getting a chance to talk to each other, talk about web stuff, all that stuff. We got here from a question from Eli Brumley, who writes in, Dear Shop Talk. What does he say, Dave?
With mobile web design on the rise, what are y'all's take on web-based push notifications? And there's a link here to goroost.com.
Which are they're similar but different things, right? First of all, maybe we should define what web-based push notifications are so I make sure that I understand them. One is that there's some kind of notification that's like when you're on that website, you know how you can do like an alert in JavaScript? There's some kind of notifications that are more native. You call a similar function with an alert and it pops up like a platform dependent kind of notification. I know in Mac, you know, they kind of come up in the upper right menu and it says like this website did something or whatever. It's a little bit like an alert. Does Windows show something?
Yeah. I think they're called toasts.
There you go.
So toast notifications or growl notifications have been the popular ones.
Those only work if you're on that website right now. Your web browser is open and you display a notification in that way. Now, then there's this whole other class of notifications that are able to work somehow, miraculously, some way, even when your web browser is closed, I think, and you're not even on that website anymore. And those are web push notifications, right? And I think they're based on the service worker universe, which I admittedly don't know a ton about, but I know some about. You know, it's a... offline usage and stuff. Like when you visit a website, it like registers this service worker in that it's JavaScript that's just kind of sitting there listening for network requests and stuff. I don't totally get it, but it's this technology that enables this web push notification such that, let's say I did them on CSS Tricks and I published a new article, I could set something up that for anybody who's like approved to get these push notifications. I could push out to all these people, CSS Strix has just published a new article. Click here to go read it. And they could click and their web browser would open and they would go to the site. Mm-hmm. I think that's how it works, right?
Yeah, yeah. It's the way I describe push notifications are push notifications are baby emails that you send to people, and they have kind of a level, different varying levels of annoyance on your phone or device or computer now. And so historically, that's kind of been for native apps that would register into the system. But browsers,
you have
are
Delta,
now,
that Delta app installed on your phone, your plane's going to be late. And now push notifications, we're more familiar with them on our mobile device. It says Delta app is telling you your plane is delayed. So you're like, oh, okay, I get it. That's a push notification on a mobile device. But so it wasn't the idea that they traditionally didn't work for websites?
Yeah, more or less like you couldn't get a native notification on a website from a website. But now the browsers have hooked into the native stuff, and now the browsers are allowing push notifications to pass through, and you kind of control that in the browser.
Yeah, you can control the messaging and presumably some of the style. I'm not sure what all the API stuff offers, but it must have come from a place where it's like, okay, native apps are kind of quote unquote winning in some sense. They can do things. They get user attention in ways that the web can't. It's got an icon on the home screen. We can do native push notifications. We have access to the accelerometer and who knows what all, you know? So there's been a push on the web. It's like, we need to give websites the same types of abilities that native apps can get. So these APIs are coming along, this being one of them. And it looks like the thing that Eli linked up here is like, I don't know, service workers aren't trivially easy to write. So why not there be some kind of middleman service to help you do this type of thing?
Yeah, and I think it also kind of offers like a hub on your website, like a third-party notification hub kind of thing. Mm-hmm. What are your thoughts on it? I think they're kind of great. I kind of see a lot of applications for push notifications. But I think with great power comes great responsibility.
Well, kind of. I think what makes them kind of great is that you can't force anybody to see these things. They're opt-in only. It's a permission-based API, just like geolocation is or whatever. Like if you go to Home Depot and do the store locator, it doesn't just immediately show you stores that are near you. In fact, it might, because it might do some IP address weirdness. But for the most part, the geolocation API is the thing to use there. But it doesn't just give Home Depot your current location. You have to approve it. Mm-hmm. A little bar comes down and you click it, whether you're on mobile or desktop or whatever. And that's the same thing here. You can't just get push notifications. A little bar comes down and approves it. And you'll see it even if you go to goroost.com. It sends down that permission thing. That way, does that sound obnoxious to get notifications when CSS Strix posts a new message? A lot of you would say yes. I don't want to be interrupted because you published a new article. That's ridiculous. So don't sign up, you know? So don't approve it.
Right. Like CSS Strix is like, I don't want blogs to tell me when, like I already have the tweets. I already have the whatever. I could get it in an email the next day, or I could just subscribe to RSS. Like I have a lot of avenues to subscribe to content. Where it might be interesting is things like, likes on your code pens or something, or if you get a new code pen follower, that's kind of stuff I'd like to know about. That's sort of stuff that, you know, I kind of don't monitor. I know you guys offer that in an email kind of format, but I'm not going to subject myself to that much email, because maybe it's only tens or thirties of likes or something, but you know, email's such a, like, oh no! If it's an email, it better be very important. It's kind of my
everybody's different in that way. Whatever you prefer is the thing to go. That might be a good use case for it, especially the particular ones or direct messages on Twitter or something. Or maybe you're building a whole new app. You're building your own social networking app, and you want ways to people notify it. And you want to build on the web. You don't want to build a native app. Well, now you kind of have those abilities. You know, like that's what these APIs are all about. So, what is our take on it? It's probably great. It's a good thing.
I think you got to make it worth it, though. I think, you know, once a technology becomes accessible, it like everyone uses it and it becomes terrible. Sort of, I guess, border radius would be a great example, or box shadow. So I think we got to be very careful. I think it's all about like, does it benefit the user to get this? Or are you just trying to re-engagement, blah, blah, blah? Don't do that. Yeah. Make sure you're benefiting the
user. Well, you hurt everybody if you abuse it, because if this becomes a thing in which that you just instinctually hit no to because there's so many spammer sites trying to get you to click the yes button, that, you know, the more people that do a good job with them, the better it's going to be for everybody.
All right. Luke Cooper writes in, I'm fairly new to web designing and I'm trying to decide the best way to start a new project. I've used lots of frameworks, Foundation, Pure, Bones, and underscores for WordPress and to forget it all, code it all myself. But because I chop and change every single time, I struggle to hit a rhythm quickly when I start a new project. I know I've benefited from changing, understanding more code, making opinions for myself rather than just trusting the frameworks. Surely every time isn't the best though. So I think he wants to kind of,
he's using a different framework every single time he picks up a new project is the
idea. Yeah. So my question is, are there things you have to have, framework or things such as normalize, et cetera, at the start of each project, or do you reach for your own stash of code? I feel like the latter is risky as I'll miss out on developments in better ways. I'm fairly new after all. But settling on one is too big a decision to make. Ah, Chris, you're kind of not a frameworker. You're not.
Well, I know, but I've always taken.
Just be honest.
Well, I am. Well, here's the honest thing. There's not a single production site I've ever shipped to the world that uses like an HTML and CSS framework in the lines of Bootstrap and Foundation. Both of which, at the same time, I'm a big fan of and think are tremendous efforts and watch people be productive with all the time. I just think if it's your job to be the person who knows super intimately the front-end development code stuff, the HTML and CSS and the JavaScript that does the interactivity of your site, that it's kind of like you should be all up in there. You should like know it better, I think, especially on like big long-term projects where you're the point person on that stuff. If you're just like, I'm the HTML and CSS guy, but I don't write it. I just use some other stuff that somebody gave us. It's like, I prefer the intimacy of writing it yourself kind of thing. And if there is no person like me on a project, but there's people that like know it a little bit, but they're more into some other aspect of the project, then reaching for those frameworks certainly doesn't hurt. I just think that's how I've always felt. I've been like, I'm supposed to be Bootstrap. I'm living Bootstrap for our project.
You're baby Bootstrap.
Yes.
Hey, baby Bootstrap. I like frameworks and I have benefited from them and I've used a lot over the years. But I've also done the thing where you like have this sort of stash, this secret stash of CSS like clips that you paste into projects and try to carry them around in a little floppy disk backpack. I've done that and that is, I don't know, that just has a propensity to be a little bit messy. I think I would, what I've kind of done over the last year is I've gone no frameworks. I've even kind of ditched SAS to a lot of degrees. And I'm writing everything on my own but I'm trying to do things in the most simple way possible. And I'm using a lot of Flexbox and things like that. You know, if you like look at Bootstrap, why would you use Bootstrap or Foundation? It's like, oh, because they have that like beautiful media component and I can use that media component. It's like you could just write your own, like crack open CodePen, take 15 minutes. You have your own and it squeezes in a browser. I'm not sure you need a whole framework just to do that. Like these like five components your website's going to use. Now, it maybe gets a little more complicated if you're doing like a fly out off canvas menu and you're like, geez, how am I going to code that? But, you know, that it's probably good to know how to code that by yourself.
I don't even care about the bloat. You know, like when you say, I don't need a whole framework just to do five components, you're right. And the usual argument there is, well, because it's just an awful lot of code then. But my argument is, well, there's more. It's because it's prescriptive, because it's not, you don't really understand how that media component was built. You just use some classes and it works, apparently. You don't understand how it was built such that you could make a variation on it when necessary, probably. Like, those are the things that strike with me stronger than, you know, oh, it's bloated or whatever. I want you to get it more. And Luke, I think you're on the right path, because you're picking different ones every time. So you're like, you're benefiting from some of the intelligence of these frameworks, but you don't use the same one every time. So you're not falling into like little personal tropes of just how you do things, because now the next project you're picking a new framework. And I think you'll get to the point where you're just like, you probably hit framework burnout and are going to start doing your own kind of as a natural course of a developer.
Here's just some inspiration for everybody. When we redesigned the accessibility project, a11yproject.com, we broke up with Bootstrap. We got rid of Bootstrap. We got rid of a lot of stuff. And the original was 3.4 megs for the accessibility site, which was just a pretty basic Bootstrap website. And the new version is 277 kilobytes. So it's down like, I don't know, like 5,000% or something, 500%. But it's, you know, it's loads, you know, 80 or 800 milliseconds faster. It has 23 less requests. It's a better, faster site. And it's kind of all we need for this project. We don't need a whole bunch of stuff. And that'll maybe grow and we'll fix things and we'll kind of grow things up. But we've drastically reduced the overhead of the
nice
accessibility project. And that's another benefit of
hopefully you did it. Stuff. Hopefully you kept the accessibility as you did it.
We did. Yeah. Well, that's another thing. You get a little some bonus points for using something somebody else made, because they probably have heard all the accessibility gripes that you haven't thought of. But we did kind of a good, decent job trying to figure out the accessibility of the site. We actually had to ditch a feature because we were going to do like the collapsing head H3s that would expand, you know, like collapse.
Like a detail summary element.
Yeah, like an accordion on mobile and a full thing on desktop. And we punted on that because we couldn't really find a good accessible way to do that. So if anyone wants to help with that, I'm sure Jerry Jones will help
that's
you.
Tough, because there's nothing easier than just not doing features, you know? Just
right.
Blast out the HTML and let it sit there.
We were just like, you know, we'll have to, like, let's just, if we can't do it right, especially on this project, let's not do it, because it's just not worth it. So
That's some real world development. We got an audio one here from Jordana Harrison. Who?
Thank you, Jordana. It's our favorite kind of question, audio questions.
Hi guys, I'm a graphic designer who's been steadily increasing my front-end skills over the last couple of years. I'm now at a point where I feel like I'm ready to start applying for front-end dev jobs, which is what I really want to do, but I'm clueless as to how those interviews usually go and how to prepare for them. Could you please run through the types of questions and tests that come up in dev interviews? As a designer, I'm used to bringing a portfolio and doing a skills test. Is it similar with development? I know I could probably Google this, but I'd like some first-hand accounts of people who have got hired and done the hiring. Thank you.
All right. I'm probably not much help here. I did recently sit in on an interview.
Did you? Where? Thing,
but, well, for this company I'm working with. But I made a very big point to not do like the whiteboard thing, but they did kind of do like a code in front of us sort of thing. But we kind of made it a point to kind of like just show us how you code. That was kind of the angle we were going for. But I think a lot of people, and I've talked to some friends who are looking for jobs, a lot of people, man, they just get grilled. It's like write an API for doing, you know, favoriting on, you know, make an API document and then write all the tests for it. And then
the secret sometimes, I mean, maybe they really were getting grilled, is that it's less about like whether you nail it and make the perfect API, but your thought process and how you went about it and when you struggled, how did you struggle? And when did you ask for clarity and all that type of stuff? So I would think that this would be kind of similar to Jordana, although who knows? And we're also, you know, like Dave said, the closest we've got to being able to answer this question is Dave said on an interview once, you know, like, I've hired some people, but like mostly it was like, I already know you're good because you're just demonstrably good. I can see your work. I'm familiar with you. I know that you're good. I think that's a big deal, too. You should have a website in which that you are demonstrably good. You're trying to be hired to be a front-end developer. I would think that you should have a personal website in which that showcases your taste and ability as a front-end developer. I mean, it's just it's a proof in the pudding kind of thing. Maybe not strictly necessary, but that would go a long way with me for sure. I've seen in some jobs in which I was familiar with the interview process that they ask you some questions about, like, you know, tell me two ways to clear a float. You know, you got three boxes. How do you give me some ways to set them all next to each other? What does Z-index do? What is one trip up thing that Z-index can happen in CSS? Tell me, you know. There's kind of simple things. I wouldn't mind that. You can certainly Google around for some front-end CSS interview-looking questions kind of thing. It wouldn't hurt to bone up on a little bit. But I would think that less than half-ish of your interview will be based on, like, CSS trick questions. And half of it will be like, do you seem like a decent person? Can you, like, talk and smile? And I don't know. Like, I hate to say that, but it's like, I want to work with people that are warm and that I like and can communicate well. And you've already said so much by the time that you're even into that interview that you'd have to really bomb a CSS trick question for me to think twice about it.
And if you're a designer that codes, Jordana, I think I could maybe get you a job real quick. So I don't really think it's I think you're in a good position, and I think for me, it's like, just be honest, but don't be insecure, right? That's another thing I've seen on the interwebs. People sometimes they overly self-deprecate, you know, but
yeah. Oh, I can't do this and run from the room, you know, like,
yeah,
that's a bad look too, because then it's just, you're showing, wow, you kind of gave up quick on that one. Like, I don't really care that you don't know how to do it. I'd rather hear you be like, well, you know, this hasn't really come up for me before, and it's not actually like ringing off a lot of bells on how I might approach this, but maybe I'd start by these search terms on the internet or something, mm-hmm. you know, so I could be like, oh, I see. So you didn't know how to do it, but at least you going to give it the old college try there.
Yeah, like, just show people how you work. That was the thing I was most interested in, is like, show me how you work. What do you Google when you're looking for problems? What do you I think having like a portfolio is good too, like, just that shows what you kind of have. Just things you've done is always a big thing. I don't know a single company or interview that doesn't ask like the "so what have you done" question. I think like that's kind of a big important place to start. But also remember, you're interviewing the company too. They're interviewing you, but you're interviewing them. You're about to enter a business relationship. So don't, if you don't like how they're conducting the interview, that's probably cool. Like that's probably a sign to you that you would not enjoy working at this place. So, I want to be like optimistic, like saying, hey, it's going to be great, you're going to get a job. But I also, like, I have friends who are going through like getting a job, and they're just getting asked the dumbest, stupidest thing, like just whiteboard questions. And I feel bad for them, because I'm just like, why would somebody even ask that? Like, you know, it's like, you don't need to know, I don't know, like computer science tricks. Is that a blog? CS tricks? like that doesn't prove much to me. It's all about like, how do you solve a problem? You know, I still Google for loops. I still Google.
And it may sound like to people out there. Frame. Sure. Certainly. It may sound like to people out there, oh, Chris and Dave are just describing an ideal world, but that's not how the real world works. And I don't know that that's true. I think I'm hearing more and more and witnessing more and more that this is how interviews actually do go down.
And maybe we should do an interview horror story episode.
Yeah.
And people send in audio questions, totally anonymous. Don't say your name. Don't say the company. Don't, like, maybe put a fake voice on and send us in your interview horror questions.
You hear it. We'll bug you on Twitter too. But Dave, you're calling it. This is a perfect idea. Call in, leave your story of, and I, you know, there's a clip to, there's a web app that we link up where you can just talk into your web browser and it will give us a thing that we can play online. Do that because it'll make a more compelling episode. And tell us if it's a horror story, great. Maybe we'll do the horror story episode, but any story about interviewing, what was the interviewing process like for you? Good or bad, funnier the better. And we'll play them. We'll do a whole interview show.
That's good.
All right. Thanks, Pierre's. We got one. This is, we have one here from Pierre's P. That's the new person. Good luck, Jordana. Pierre's P. Dave, I want to know about this question so much that I want an answer. Because I don't necessarily know how to handle this. Pierre says, I know it's best practice to do one DOM lookup per element. Let's stop there. So you need a reference to an element on the page in the DOM because you're going to do something with it. You've heard before, like, you should probably do like a query selector all by like ID or get element by ID because getting a reference to ID is very fast, right? But more than that, you probably only want to do that like once, right? Because querying the DOM is kind of expensive. Now that you've cached that element, now you have access to it for as long as that element exists. So that's very efficient to get a reference to an element by ID and then only do it once and keep that reference around so that you can use it. So I know it's best practice to do one DOM lookup per element, then save it as a variable for future reference. How do you handle this using ES6 module or ES2015, I think is the more correct way to say it, modules? I find myself searching for the same element multiple times across different modules. So now that we're in this world where it's much more common to have lots and lots of separate JavaScript files that all have smaller tasks to do, be them modules or files that ultimately get concatenated together or whatever. But, you know, I've been working a lot in modules these days. You find like, oh, shoot, I need access to the header element again because three different files need access to the header element again. And I've always been like, shoot, should there be some kind of like global registry of, a file whose whole job it is to like, you know, cache DOM selectors for me, and then that gets included in every file because of this? Or is it just like, you know, is this micro optimization and I shouldn't be thinking that hard about it? But, you know, I bet, you know, there's a lot of times, you know, within the CodeBend code base where we have to get a reference to the body element. That one's not a big deal because I think you kind of get a freebie to that one. It's just kind of built into the DOM. But like, there's other ones that aren't quite that easy to get your hands on. That's like, man, there's got to be 50 places in this app where we're querying the DOM to get a reference to that element across all these different files. That seems wild. Was that long-winded? Do you understand the problem?
Yeah, I think the answer is just use React. Boom. Next question. No.
It's true, though. In React, you really don't need
React
that.
React actually solves this problem. Yeah. I think there's it totally depends on your situation, your application. But let's use CodePen as an example. You're querying the menu, the change view button or something. You almost do kind of need like a global thing if a bunch of things are hooking up into that, because the future I'm seeing is somebody comes along and renames an ID or something. Or you're doing A/B testing and the IDs can be totally random, right?
Sure.
And now you have to like go through every file that references that ID that you're for the header change view button. And now you have to like go through and change all the selectors.
Yeah, it's weird. Selectors. You know, there's just no, I've never seen a strategy for like DOM reference management.
Yeah. There's kind of, I don't know if you follow the microservice architecture versus monolith hot drama, chung debate, but, I think it's Go. I'm going to say it's Golang. They actually prefer a little bit of copy pasting over hyper modularization. And so this is sort of the same thing. Like you're creating this basically header selector module to solve this problem, and then everyone else hooks into the header selector module and requires it, and they know how to select the header. So you basically created a new dependency versus just selecting it again, right? I think I tend to lean to just select it again. I think that the Go way is maybe more pragmatic. You know, your modules should also be independent. Like they should do their own thing. They should handle their own concerns. I will say, if you're like selecting children and stuff, try to do that off the parent node. But I would say the best I've ever done
is to just do like at the top of the file, list all the fairly high in the file, our structure at CodePen before all this new React stuff we're doing, which is so awesome, by the way, but another time. Some of our older school jQuery stuff, we have a formula for each kind of module that we write. They're not modules in the strictest sense, but we kind of think of them as modules. Like this file, this is the job of this file, and it has this structure. It's an iffy that has public functions and private stuff. It's very like very organized way to do it. At the top of those iffies is kind of like these are the DOM elements that are used within this file, and they're right at the top, and they get selected once so that they don't have to be selected again. And if there's something that like Ajax is in or whatever, it makes like a placeholder one up there. So it's like, no, we can't run this right now against the DOM because that stuff doesn't exist yet, but it will. And it makes a note as to when it's going to happen. So I think being clear is probably more important than peers being clear.
I agree with that. So, all right. Well, good luck. Hopefully our ambiguity doesn't make you further spiral you into rage. Michael Hannon writes in, "Hey guys, what do you use for cross-browser CSS print page numbers? It seems like each browser has their own idea in 2016. Why can't they recognize the need for printing from the web and create a standard?" And there's a Stack Overflow link.
I put that in there because I was like, I don't know. Maybe that's like useful-ish kind of. What I would love to know in this situation is, why do you need to print page numbers in the thing? I'm sure you do. I don't necessarily doubt your use case, but I want to know what it is, because every time I try to picture one, I'm like, I don't know that I need to. Maybe it's for order. Like if you had an article that was 20 pages or more and you were worried that, I don't know, they might get out of order at some point, the having the page numbers on there sure as heck makes them a lot easier to reorder, I guess. But then, like, why do you really care what they look like? I feel like most printers just will do this for you. You know, they're like, there's like a checkbox. It's like, print page numbers, yes or no.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I guess you have to kind of consider like all these operating systems, all these different things.
And then CSS has some way to do it, but it's not particularly well supported across different browsers, which does not surprise me at all, because this is such a weird thing.
Yeah, there's a counter increment property in CSS where you can use this on your pages. Like you can make your own LI incrementer on a
but how would you LI. But that makes sense because there's multiple elements. But when a single article just happens to break across pages, there's not multiple elements happening. It's all still one element. So I think that's where at page comes in. Is I think at page is like, it knows about page breaks somehow magically.
Yeah.
I don't really get what that page does, I hate to admit.
Yeah. It seems like a opera's figures, CSS figures thing. I don't know. I'm sort of like, if you have to have these page numbers or whatever, like maybe you're getting into generate a PDF from HTML territory. Does that make sense? And that's a lot of action. That's a lot of coding, but it can be done. But that might be something. I will go ahead and confess, I am not a print style sheet guy, and I know
I like working on print tacky style sheets, but I'm trying to figure out how this could happen. Like what is the way in which to actually get those numbers on there. Because, I mean, I'm sure you can imagine everybody's got a slightly different printer. I mean, there's the normal, you know, 8.5 by 11 kind of thing, but certainly there's giant sheets that can be printed and really tiny printers and stuff. How do you know about that from CSS? Is there any way at all to know about that? I kind of don't think that there is. I don't know. I would trust the printer to do it and just just tell people to turn on their thing that way. Also, you know, maybe the way to do it is to make like really like divs throughout your entire article and like make them small enough that they probably will fit, and then do page break before always in your CSS. So it for sure breaks the page at that moment. And then you could apply like a pseudo element to each one of those divs that you could then style appropriately. But like having divs all up and down your article just for the sake of printing, and then having no absolute guarantee that those are going to fit on one particular page, freaks me out.
Yeah, I think it's like a surrender control thing. And again, back if you need the fidelity, like if you're like an ebook shop or something, you might have to get into generating PDFs.
PDF line.
So that's which is. I don't know. I've done it before. It's kind of fun, but it's also kind of a mind bender. So good luck, Michael. Sorry, don't have a great answer there for you. Andrew Garman writes in, Google Insights is saying to move jQuery and jQuery Migrate to the footer of my WordPress install. Is there a reason why WordPress doesn't move jQuery and jQuery Migrate to the footer by default? Beautiful question, actually. Is there a way to do this without decoupling the included jQuery, jQuery Migrate that come with WordPress? So you've probably run into this. Every time you do a WordPress, you have to like dequeue jQuery and then WP enqueue jQuery footer true. There's a way to enqueue your script in the footer.
It's actually not that bad. It would be a two-liner because you'd have to dequeue the default jQuery and then just re-enqueue it, but you just re-enqueue it with the same exact little string handle thing that is already there, and then just put true at the end, because true is the very last parameter of WP enqueue script is whether it should be in the footer or not. So it's probably a fairly trivial thing to switch. Why doesn't it do it by default? I don't know. I suspect that they have some use. They're smart. They know what they're doing. This isn't a mistake from the WordPress clan. I suspect that it just causes more trouble than it's worth, because there's probably some people that, for better or worse, have themes in which that load other scripts in the header and expect jQuery to be there. And the second that they flip it over and load it in the footer, it's gonna throw all these, you know, dollar sign is not defined errors or whatever. So they're just like, ugh, can't do it, not yet. It's a better world to load it in the footer, that's for sure. And you should be loading it in the footer. So,
yeah. Well, I wonder. I wonder if it's a huge like misarchitecture, like, or just almost ignorance. We didn't know back then how bad a script in the head was, you know.
Yeah, and that was the default for a long time. So it's hard.
And back then, I'm saying like 8 years ago or something. But that was the default, and I think there are probably just too many sites that depend on that. So it's. That's bad. I mean,
fortunately, they made it really easy.
I would get so many emails. We would get so many Fitvids is broken on my website. You know, like Fitvids is not available because somebody would just enqueue it wrong. You know, so we'd get so many emails. It'd be so bad.
You all out there should almost subscribe to the Fitvids thread just to experience what Dave's life is like a little bit.
Comedy gold / slight verbal abuse. Pretty cool.
Yeah, there was a couple of good ones last week of somebody who's just like, do I have to personally go around the entire internet telling people how stupid you are?
Just because he wanted to use window.resize anyway.
It was he's like, you fools, this is how you handle this problem, and then put some code there that's like super bad news. Anyway, whatever.
Hey,
goodbye forever.
Christopher Vincent writes in. You want to do this one? Or?
Sure, I'll do it. My question is about attending conferences. Speaking of which, in a few days, Dave and I will be at Web Design Day. But by the time you hear this, it will probably be already over. Sorry, but listen to an upcoming episode where we'll probably post the audio from our live show there. So, Christopher, we attend conferences sometimes. I'm a newbie, and I have recently started doing part-time freelance web design and development. I've learned so much from listening to y'all's podcasts as well as others. I feel like the next step to leveling up and staying current is to start attending conferences. However, the costs of traveling to a conference can add up pretty quickly between the actual cost of the conference, plane tickets, hotel rooms. We could add to that list, you know? Mm-hmm. Miller Lights.
Yeah, well, buddy.
Qdoba. Yes.
a massage to work off the Miller
Exactly. Events. Big plants. As a newbie and freelancer, should I be going to conferences regularly, or are they more for experts? Concerning costs, are the conferences something that could be considered something a tax write-off? Thanks for your time. Tax write-off, absolutely.
Absolutely. Write it off.
Yep. Well,
write
you're
that
a,
mother off.
Literally a freelancer, and this is an industry event. That is absolutely okay. It is not a tax loophole or anything. Write that sucker off for sure. I mean, that doesn't help a ton with the cost, but it helps a little bit. You know, you're not paying taxes on whatever the, you know, whatever income versus what that conference costs or whatever. You try to do it on the cheap. You know, I'm sure you're familiar with a longtime sponsor we've had at Shop Talk Show. We haven't had in a while, but the Environments for Humans, people do the online ones. Those are pretty cool too, and certainly a lot cheaper because you don't have to pay for the plane tickets and hotel rooms and all that stuff, but certainly aren't as immersive as going to an online conference, or the opposite of that, in person.
Yeah. I would say absolutely this is for you. I think in some ways it is kind of the next step to leveling up. And that's not to say no judgment if you don't like conferences or don't go, but you get forced in a position where you have to meet people who do the same job as you. And a lot of good can come of that. I feel like, you know, Chris, you and I met at a conference and now we do a podcast every week. It's mm-hmm. great. I think there's a lot of good in social good that can come from going to conferences and talking to people. From a business standpoint, I think absolutely it's important. I think A, you're furthering your education. B, you might meet somebody who has, you know, they're looking for they don't want to hire somebody, but they need somebody to pitch in on a job. You could build a relationship with the company. I just referred some friends to Jason Van Loo in Orlando because he needed a freelancer and I know some people. So it's like this stuff happens. So I would add
a little bit to it.
Conferences.
In that, like, are you thinking about going all by yourself? And where do you exist on the spectrum of introversion to extroversion? So I would say if you're super introverted, like I'm pretty far down the introvert path myself, you know, believe it or not or whatever. I know that at the end of a day at a conference, I just want to go back to my hotel room and rent a very expensive movie and watch it and wake up the next morning. Like, I'm done at the end of these things usually. And I would think that, like, if you're alone and you're highly introverted, that it honestly doesn't bode well for the conferences so much to me. Like, maybe, like, not to the point of don't go. I think you should at least go to one to feel yourself out at these things. But, like, I don't know. It seems sad to me to watch someone come to a conference, experience the conference all day, have this, like, awkward lunch where you're sitting by yourself, and then be so wiped out by the end of it because it was such a weird thing that you just go back to your hotel room and fall asleep. That was a lot of money for nothing. If you're highly extroverted, I think you'll probably have a little bit more fun of a time at these things where you just can't wait till the party at night, so you're bouncing around talking to everybody and stuff. I think that you'll probably get a little bit more out of it than someone who kind of struggles with the social situation thing. I hate to, you know, whatever. Let's just grain of salt.
No,
that.
I agree. Like, I've been at conferences where I'm speaking but I'm just kind of like, I'm having tough times talking to people. So like my fun level's kind of like, you know, kind of dipping, but usually by like the night I end up having fun. So,
they're usually a little drinky, by the way. Sometimes
I was on a boat
for those of us who
I made a few mistakes on a boat. Yeah. Once one thing I would recommend, if you just want to do the educational side, these online conferences, a free advertisement here for Environments for Humans. They put on really great ones, really affordable, really like the price point's perfect. The amount of time, even if you can't make a whole day, you can like watch talks later. It's really great. But they also do an in-person one. The CSS DevConf is coming up in October.
I'm going to be. Are you going to that or just me?
I know Trent is going, but I might, I might go. I'm just, I don't, my kid's birthday's around then, but.
I didn't mean to put you on the spot. I'll be there.
No. Yeah. Chris will be there. But, and it's right in my backyard. I really need to go, but it's at the Alamo. Like, it's going to be fun in San Antonio. It should, in San Antonio, like downtown San Antonio, almost like an adult amusement park. It should be really good. So I'm just saying this only because, like, I think, like, if you like this show, you're going to like that conference.
You'll, I would, like, say that, yeah, CSS DevConf is a very shop talk friendly.
And then if you like this show, you know, there's, you know, an Event Apart, Smashing Conf are also good conferences you should come.
Oh, if you're looking, you know, for the list, out. We did that. In fact, I was talking to Sarah Drasner, who put the list together for CSSTricks.com. She's updating it tonight. We just made like a huge guide of like 2016 conferences, you know.
See?
We could link that baby up.
There you go. And some conferences are 1 day, 2 day, 3 day. You pick and choose. So
we're fans. I think it's safe to say that we're largely fans of these things.
Yeah.
Okay. Right. What do we got? Dan Richman? Is that where we're at?
Dan Richman writes in, I often hear Shop Talk that preprocessors should always be set to minify CSS. It's suggested that we will have slow sites. Otherwise, I'm a huge fan of preprocessors, and I agree that concatenating reduces slow HTTP requests, but my team thinks the benefits of CSS minification are way overstated. For instance, look at the size of a CSS file like Twitter's Bootstrap and compare it to the minified CSS. The minified version offers a savings of 24 KB, which is great. However, CSS should always be served with server-side gzip. So if you compare the gzip CSS files, the savings is only 2 KB between the pretty CSS and the minified CSS. And there's a little illustration, a little screenshot to show that off. Clearly, the benefits of concatenation are huge, but the loss of CSS line numbers really worth saving 2 KB on an average website that is being QA'd every day. What are your thoughts?
Well, the thoughts are that you're right. I mean, there's no way to argue against this. The gzipping is way, way, way more important for the performance of your website than minification is, right? But it's also a freebie to minify. So, you know, go for it.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you're processing your CSS anyway. You might as well minify it. Like, what's the difference between clicking the button or not clicking the button? I think, Dan, you were saying, well, then you lose the line numbers in the dev tools. You don't really, because, well, I mean, you do if you do it wrong or whatever. Or not wrong, I should say, but don't use a source map. But that's what source maps are all about, which are, like, widely supported everywhere. So, like, when you minify it, whatever tool you're using to process it, tell that thing to make a source map while it's doing it, which any good minifier will do, and then you get the line numbers too. So it's kind of like, it's okay, it's only 2K, but it's totally free 2K. You did almost no work to get the 2K, so do it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, you let a robot do the work. It's not, you're not like manually minifying these, like pasting it into a website and minifying. So I think, you know, I think the robot should be able to do it. And maybe it, you know, goes through QA unminified, and then you just know you have a minification process, you know, afterwards. And it's, I don't know. It's been a long time before I've ran into like a minifying bug. I can't even remember that I ever have. So
yeah, those get stamped out pretty quickly. So,
and now you like have source maps too. So the minification can map to an actual source file too. You'll see on Shop Talk Show, we have a lot of source map bugs because we forgot to commit the source maps. But
I have a post that's exactly, oh yeah, that's right. We did do that. So
it's my fault.
It throws an error. There's a post that's exactly about this using the exact same demo you used on CSS Tricks that attempts to make the points that we just said. And one additional point at the end is that some browsers, well, there's, even without doing this, there's a little bit of evidence that browsers can read through and parse and do the stuff that it needs to do on a CSS file a little bit faster on minified files than non-minified files. Not a ton, but a little bit. And to the point, other in Windows 10, Microsoft Edge, friends of Shop Talk Show, they're literally optimizing their CSS parser for minified files.
Hey, there you go. Trump card. It's I'll huge.
Read the quote. Do you want me to read the quote? This is from their a blog post on blogs.windows.com. So in Windows 10 and Microsoft Edge, we've added a few new fast paths, improved inlining, and optimized some heuristic for Chakra's JIT compiler to ensure that minified code runs as fast, if not faster, than minified versions. With these changes, the performance of individual code patterns minified using UglifyJS, which does CSS2, I think, improved between 20 and 50%. So the parsing of a minified file faster between 20 and 50%, which is kind of huge. Although I don't know. It might be like 1 millisecond versus 2 milliseconds or something, which is no.
Here's another data point. Back in 2010, I wrote a blog post called Web Performant WordPress, where I this was my first time optimizing my WordPress site, one of my WordPress sites. I had 248 kilobytes of unminified CSS in my website. And I minified it down to 70.82 kilobytes. So I it's a quarter of the size or a third of the size. And I shaved off a whole half second on my load time. So that's very much worth it in my book.
You're also not wrong, Dan Richman. You're also the gzipping thing. And caching trumps all of this.
Yeah, gzipping, caching, well, and service workers, throwing in a service worker now, you're going to be hot on fire. But
this is named micro-optimization, but it's one worth doing.
I think, because ideally your CSS is well-commented, and you'd never want to send those, don't send those comments down. The user's not going to benefit from that. That's for internal use only.
I even write my HTML comments in little Ruby comment tags or PHP comment tags. Because I'm like, don't need to go down there. This don't need to go down the pipe.
Let's end that.
Let's do one more and then call it, shall we?
All right. Last one comes from Thor Cardell. Is it a bad practice to use Bootstraps or other CSS libraries hidden-md, hidden-sm, hidden-xs to make responsive layouts? It seems like the easiest way, but obviously it makes the DOM heavier. An example could be desktop navigation and a mobile navigation.
This is kind of interesting. I wasn't aware of these, but they have a very clear page that explains it all. So hidden-md means that it's, and apparently these have changed over time. I feel like this is a slightly old question. It's the new classes, apparently, according to at least the V4 Bootstrap, is a class like hidden-md-down or hidden-md-up, which is it's hidden at a medium-ish screen size and up. Or shown on a smaller than medium size screen, so it's kind of like it's just a little helper class to hide things in certain situations using media query logic, meaning at this size or bigger or at this size or smaller. And is it bad practice to use them? You can't just I don't know if you have to be dogmatic and pick one. I'd say it's better not to. I think Dave has mentioned on the show before, it's just if it's not there and it's intended to do nothing, it shouldn't be in the DOM at all.
Yeah. Well, hey, sorry, Chris. Somebody's coming in my office. They wanted to say something.
Okay.
Well, I do declare using unsemantic hiding classes is an abomination. I do declare.
Wow, web standard Southern gentlemen, you sure are.
Why would you put a saddle on a horse if you're not going to ride it? Different horses for different sizes. That's ridiculous.
That one didn't scale, did it, web standard Southern gentlemen? Well, thank you, Colonel Standards, for coming by the show. We really appreciate you and understand your harsh allegiance to semantic HTML. So I think I'm using
these classes exist does not offend me.
I'm using them in a project and it gets the job done. I think that's the thing about it is I think we all feel a little dirty or something, but it's just like, I'm just getting the job done. And I'm going to walk away happier.
What's the alternative? Be like, oh, we can't pull off the same navigation between these two things because it's too complicated. So we really need two different sets of HTML to handle the medium device navigation versus the extra large device navigation. So what we do is we just like hide one or the other, depending on which is shown. And somebody's like, oh, I can't believe you would do that. You know, oh, you should like be testing the media query through JavaScript and Ajaxing in the correct, you know, like that solution kind of sucks too.
Yeah, we should do a 40-week exploration on the perfect navigation that doesn't repeat anything, a single line of code. Again, back to this don't repeat yourself versus a little bit of copy and paste. It's, you know, like think about it. Think about it.
I feel like the DOM weight thing is always a little tough. You know, like, is it the DOM weight really when it's like 10 lines of HTML? Or is that so trivial that it's like, shrug, who cares? You know, like at what point, how much HTML, like how nested does it have to be? How many elements does it have to be where it really actually is a concern?
Yeah, I mean, I'm like, I don't know. I think it does have like impact and you know, if you have a heavy site, it's just, you made it even heavier by repeating yourself. Like, but it's honestly, it's a design problem too. It's like, you've designed something that doesn't, you know, doesn't quite work super great. So, you know, but I don't know. Again, I'm very permissive web standards. Kernel WB standards over here is very particular about it. So, do what makes you feel happy. Whatever gets you to beer 30 quicker is optimized for beer 30, I believe, is the title of this episode. And Chris, I think we're going to have to wrap it up. What a fun little rapid fire. Thanks, everyone, for listening. In your podcatcher of choice, be sure to star heart favorite it, tweet about it. That's how people find out about the show. And be sure to follow us on Chop Talk at Shop Talk Show on Twitter for tens of tweets a month. We will be coming at you with a live episode, hopefully, if the audio captures okay, from Web Design Day in Pittsburgh. So look out for that in your podcatcher this week. And Chris, you got anything else?
ShopTalkershow.com.